It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. Lots to talk about, including the Face Recognition Moratorium Act and, the new encryption law about to be voted on in Congress. He'll also talk a little bit about Ripple 20 once again. It's getting even worse. It's all coming up next on Security Now. Security Now comes to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes enterprise-level security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/Twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson. Episode 773, recorded Tuesday, June 30th, 2020, Ripple 22. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by Melissa. Like expired milk, 30% of your customer data goes bad every year, and that's money down the drain. Visit Melissa's developer portal for free access to data quality APIs, demos, and code samples. Freshen up your sour data today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. And by Red Hat OpenShift. Red Hat OpenShift is the Kubernetes platform that provides a trusted foundation for the on-premises, hybrid, and multi-cloud deployments today's enterprises demand. Go to openshift.com/security now to check out its features. And by ExpressVPN. Now that a lot of you are working from home, it's even more important to choose a VPN you trust. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/security now. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security, your privacy, and your computer and how it works. All with this guy right here is the king of Security Now, the guy in charge, Mr. Steve Gibson. Hello, Steve.
Leo, great to be with you again. Yes, I'm saluting with my other hand because the microphone is blocking my normal salutation. Because outside the house is a wood chipper, which is grinding up Lord knows what. Sounds like bricks. But the good news is these amazing Heil microphones we use are extremely directional. And so even though it's a kind of a pain due to my setup to put the microphone on the other side, I had sufficient notice to do so today. And the microphone is aimed away from the wood chipper rather than right at it. So I figured that was a good thing to do for the sake of our listeners, whom we care so much about. That's why we're here every week for 773 weeks. That's our episode for the end of the month, end of June. More news, details actually, have come to light about the really horrific Ripple 20 vulnerabilities. And so I, with a little tongue in cheek, I called this episode Ripple 22 TOO because we need, now that we know a lot more detail, you know, exactly which hundreds of millions of devices are vulnerable to this longstanding multi-decade worrisome TCP/IP stack vulnerability set. I thought we needed to follow up with that. And there wasn't anything else that was breathtaking that happened, although lots of interesting news. We've got the actual shortening of certificate lifetime change, which we'll remember was something that Apple surprised everybody with in, back in February. Other people are coming on board, so we need to update on that. We also have Apple's interesting decision to deliberately ignore their support for a bunch of new web APIs. They've said, no, thank you. And frankly, I can't disagree.
Yeah, when I read them, I thought the browser could tell you that.
I know. And that's, you know, that's what's so nutty about what the W3C consortium are doing. They've got to be sitting around in like some sort of a, you know, brainstorming meeting, asking themselves, what else can we do?
What other features can we build in?
Yeah, Yeah, like how many icons are on the user's desk? It's like, what? You know, well, that could be useful. Oh, okay, let's put that in there. Oh, anyway, we've also got Apple's kind of weird announcement of the way they're going to be implementing DOH DOH and DOT, which we're going to cover. Some troubling, believe it or not, Mozilla Comcast news. Also, we've got some welcome legislation to head off the use of facial recognition. A less welcome attempt to outlaw strong encryption, another one, separate from the Earn It Act, but with a common sponsor, not surprisingly.
And even more clear in its desire. Oh, boy.
Yes, it is very explicit. Yeah. It doesn't have the slime factor that Earn It did, but it's still like in your face. We're also going to look at the growing legislation against, thank goodness, mandatory chipping of people, not pets, but yes, people. And I wanted to remind our listeners about the utility of VirusTotal as a consequence of my having touched it recently and also some news there. Then we're going to catch up with some bit of miscellany, some listener feedback, and then revisit last week's very worrisome revelation about the many flaws in a, as we know, very widely used embedded TCP/IP stack. And I still have the feeling, even with all this, that we're just, you know, looking at the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
We will see.
Bad news. I think Anthony Fauci says that you should stop touching your VirusTotal. But we'll talk about that later, okay?
Good idea. And I forgot to ask you how many sponsors we have this week.
Three. We'll start with the first of three right now. The good folks at Melissa, they are amazing. And I got a recently, I got a real appreciation for why you want your customer data to be accurate. We had a, we were selling masks through a third party. We don't do any of our merchandise. There's a really good one, by the way, now, Steve, a mask with your likeness on it, or you can get a bandana with your likeness on it. That's in our Twit store, twit.tv/store. I'm going to get 100 of them because I want to wear Steve everywhere I go. But we're using a different company for a while. And we started to get emails from people saying, you know, I ordered a mask. I just got the confirmation. I don't live in Florida, but it's just going to Florida. And this was a perfect example of what a disaster it can be if your customer data is a mess. And it does. Milk in your fridge goes bad. You want to check the date on it, you know, the best by date. Your customer data has a best by date. 30% of customer data goes bad every year. We, by the way, have moved to a different provider, and we will refund you all. But and I'm also going to send a note to those guys saying, you ought to be using Melissa. Melissa makes sure your data is accurate and current so you get the right customers and you don't send all your masks to Florida. Their tools have helped businesses maintain fresh data for a long time. I was talking to them the other day. They've been doing this for 35 years. They started with zip code verification. And then as the world has expanded, they've added more and more tools and APIs and better ways to validate not just addresses, but everything. Everything. Emails, phone numbers, names. You can even add customer demographic records like property and mortgage data, marital status, social media handles. Melissa will fill in the gaps, adding emails and phone numbers, and what they will also do is eliminate bad data. That's maybe even more important. They can enhance your existing data, but they can also make sure they can dedupe, they can get rid of, you know, a customer that lives in Columbus, Ohio, that you're going to send their stuff to Florida. That's not good. That's not good. Incorrect data is, you know, it propagates. It's entered by customers, you know, human error, duplicated records. People who use Melissa are getting so much more accurate information now. It's used in customer service centers everywhere. In fact, they have a great API. So if you've got custom software, You can, and this is many, I won't say names, but many companies, big companies now are using this. They start typing the address. Melissa fills it in and says, is this correct? And that saves a lot of keying and it saves a lot of errors. Melissa's matching and deduplication tools will help you uncover, merge, and purge hard to find duplicate records. You'll get an accurate 360 degree view of your customers. They have all sorts of ways to use it. On premises, you can use it as a web service. You can upload a data file there, have them cleanse it. They support secure FTP, SaaS delivery. You just choose the best way to meet your needs. By the way, I should point this out. We didn't mention it last time about Melissa, but I want to make sure you understood. They undergo constant independent security audits because they've got a lot of data. They want to make sure that you trust them. They've got absolute commitment to data security, privacy, and compliance. So you can be sure that that data is being treated absolutely as it is, like precious cargo. Strong controls and safeguards at all times. 10,000 businesses now trust the address experts at Melissa. You can trust Melissa to be your foundation for data-driven success. By the way, they're doing something else really great, and I wanted to mention this as well. If you are a community or organization or essential worker during COVID-19, your organization could qualify for 6 months of free service at Melissa. There's an online form you can fill out. See if you qualify. Nonprofits, there are medical institutions, essential workers of all kinds. So if you're essential during this COVID crisis, Melissa wants to help. Don't put up with expired cartons of milk, and don't put up with sour customer contact data. You want to make sure you go through Melissa. You can try their APIs in the developer portal. It's very easy to log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox. That's there for you 24/7. In fact, you can get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free. You pick the way you want to do it at melissa.com/twit. M-E-L-I-S-S-A. Melissa.com/twit. Check out the developer portal. And I know there are a lot of online stores. Lots of people, for a variety of reasons, using Melissa. I just wish those guys who are selling our masks were. Melissa.com/twit. Yeah, Steve Gibson bandana. I'll show you. It's just awesome.
It does occur to me that, like, you know, smiling is a nice thing to do to people, and no one can tell you're smiling behind the mask. So
you can get anything with Steve's.
You know, take a picture with a smile.
You can get a bib with Steve's face on it if you want. Seriously, up at the top there, if you go to twit.tv/store and hit the customize button right here, you could put Steve's image. They have a lot of different things, and not just Steve, of course, all of our shows. So there's the mask with Steve Gibson on it. You can make it bigger. I mean, this is really a nice store. So, and they will mail. Wow. People are actually receiving these. I want this bandana. I think that's really cool. See your mustachioed face smugly smiling out at me.
When it was still dark.
It's only $11. I love it. Anyway, that's not Melissa. I should take down the Melissa lower third. That's just something else we do. Go ahead, Steve.
Just something else offered. Yeah. So last February, we talked about Apple's surprise announcement during the CA Browser Forum that in the future, and this was just unilateral, that in the future, it, for Safari, on all of its platforms, would be rejecting any web server certificate having a not valid before date, which is technically the way the date range is stated, so it's very clear, not valid before date after August 31st of this year, of 2020, and which has a certificate lifetime greater than, total lifetime, greater than 398 days. So in other words, starting just 2 months from now, that is to say from September 1st on, all CA certificates issued for use by web browsers must be issued with a 1 year plus 33 days lifetime or shorter. not longer. So this is the death of the more arguably convenient 2 or 3 year web server search that we've traditionally been using. Essentially, sort of Apple biting the bullet and pushing an issue that the various non-certificate authority participants in the so-called the CAB forum, the CA browser forum, had been asking for a long time. Google had put forth this issue, this measure for a vote at the prior meeting, and it had been voted down in a partisan vote by the certificate authorities that said, no, we don't want to shorten, you know, server certificates to a year. Well, Apple said, okay, tough. We're just not going to accept any. And, you know, arguably Safari is strong enough that that basically they forced the issue. So when I talked about this initially in February, I discussed the many implications of this in great depth and detail. So I'm not going to go into all that again. If anyone has joined us since then or wants a refresher, it's back in February. The reason this is back in the news is that now the other two significant browsers in the industry, Mozilla and Google, it's all Chromium-based offshoots of Google's Chrome browser, have also announced their exactly aligned policies.
Yes.
Google's
that's really interesting. Wow.
Yes.
That'll
Google's
hurry
Ryan
up.
Sleavey, yeah, he posted and as sort of like their equivalent of like things were going to change in the Chromium blog, he said, enforce 398-day validity for certificates issued on or after 2020-9-01, September 1st of this year. And then the body of the message is enforce publicly trusted TLS server certificates have a lifetime of 398 days or less if they are issued on or after, you know, September 1st, 2020. And he said certificates that violate this will be rejected with, and then the error is error certificate validity too long and will be treated as misissued. And also following up, Mozilla's Kathleen Wilson posted limit reuse of domain name verification to 395 days, and that was pound 206. And I think she did say 395 because I'm sure I copied and pasted. So they're off by three. It should be 398. I believe that because I remember 1 year plus 33 was, and that's, you know, to sort of give people a little bit of fudge room. So there is a long and very interesting discussion for people who like such things among the industry insiders who are the ones who make these essentially earth-moving decisions. So I've included the Google Groups discussion thread link in the show notes for anyone who's interested. I mean, it's, you know, it's back and forth and a lot of discussion, but basically it comes down to, well, you know, this is what we wanted. Thank you, Apple, for biting the bullet. We're all going to jump on board. And, you know, the certificate authorities will end up changing their model rather than, like, for example, you having to have a cash transaction annually. You'll be able to, like, purchase some block of time that you want to have certificates from them. And I imagine, since that does create a little bit of lock-in, that they may extend that. You know, they may say, hey, you know, stay with us, commit to staying with us for 10 years, and we will lower the per-year cost of certificates. And then it'll be like, you know, you log into your account and basically you reissue a certificate before the one you have expires. What this will also do, you know, we always run across instances where people are forgetting or sort of like letting it lapse, or maybe it's a holiday or it's a COVID-19 event. One way or the other, server certificates are expiring, And they're finding out only when people are screaming that they can no longer access the website. So maybe it being an annual thing, and it's as opposed to, for example, every 3 years, which maybe you're more likely to forget, that might help prevent that. And hopefully, I know in my relationship with DigiCert, you know, I'm getting email from them all the time saying, hey, this or that's getting ready to expire. So, you know, don't let that, you know, slip by. So you certainly want to be, you know, I mean, in general, absolutely want to make sure you have an email address that allows you to receive important security notifications. I would argue that notes from your certificate authority is one class. And as we'll be seeing in several of the stories that we have this week, it's absolutely important, crucial for the software that you're using to the vendors of the software that you're using have a way to reliably get a hold of you to tell you when there's some action you need to take. And when you get that kind of notice, at least open the mail. Make sure, you know, judge for yourself how important it is, because, you know, it can be really crucial. We were talking at the top of the show, Leo, because you were looking also at these web APIs. I mentioned that Safari has chosen to eschew adopting these 16 web APIs for the sake of user privacy. I would argue, and who cares? You know, like the magnetometer, okay. Apple has decided not to build these newly defined APIs into Safari because they both individually and collectively could pose a credible threat to user privacy by opening new opportunities for user fingerprinting. So let's quickly enumerate these. Web Bluetooth, which allows websites to connect to nearby Bluetooth LE devices. That one, I don't know. I could see some uses for that. You know, frankly, as the designer of Squirrel, if we reliably had a Bluetooth connectivity to the browser, that would create a direct connection between somebody's phone and the browser to create a local authentication loop to close that loop that no bad guy, you know, in Russia or China or some other foreign land could intercept. So that one's a little near and dear to my heart, but it's not available in Chrome. Okay, the MIDI API, right? MIDI, which allows websites to enumerate, manipulate, and access MIDI devices. Okay. The magnetometer API, allowing websites to access data about the local magnetic field surrounding a user as detected by the device's primary magnetometer sensor.
Well, there you go.
Which direction are you facing? And you know, and for example, we've talked in the past about the battery API. And one of the problems was that it offered so much resolution, you know, like, I don't remember now, 16 bits of resolution, that if an ad could read your battery level, and then you, as a user, went to a different, completely unaffiliated website with exactly the same 16-bit battery level. Okay, 16 bits does not uniquely disambiguate you from the rest of the world, but when that is added to any other browser-sniffing, fingerprinting behavior that may be available, you know, it represents a bunch of additional bits of what would that be? De-entrification? There's a new word. Entropication. De-entropication. No.
There you go.
Anyway. So magnetometer, which direction you're facing. And I just should mention that as a consequence of that, it was decided that we did not need 16 bits of battery state, but it would, might still be nice to have some. So some of the browsers just, you know, fuzzed out the lower bits. They just said, eh, we're not going to tell you exactly what the user's battery level is because you don't need to know. You only need to know, you know, if it's low enough that you shouldn't start a processor intensive, you know, cryptocurrency mining on their browser right now, or you'll, you know, burn up their battery. Anyway, we also have the NFC API, which would allow websites to communicate with NFC tags through a device's NFC reader. Eh, that seems sort of useful, but not in Safari. The device memory API, allowing websites to receive the approximate amount of device memory in gigabytes. Eh, to me, that seems like it's simply for the purpose of tracking someone. So, yeah. Could do without that one. The network information API, providing information about the connection a device is using to communicate with a network and provides a means for scripts to be notified if the connection type changes. Eh, I would worry about that from a security standpoint. That sounds like it could be, you know, leaking something that bad guys might use. I mean, I'm sure they would have thought about that in the W3C consortium, but still. And speak of the devil, the battery status API, allowing websites to receive information about the battery status of the hosting device. I guess other browsers that have it are reducing its resolution. Apple says, no, none of your business. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because, I mean, there are enough of these that it means that, there are enough of these that Safari's not going to be supporting that it sort of limits websites' ability to depend upon those. On the other hand, we've seen the numbers and the Chromium browsers, which, by the way, are the browsers that support almost all of these, if not all of these, just because that's where Chromium is. You know, they have the lion's share. So I guess if nothing else, websites will have to be able to tolerate a lack of some of this functionality. Maybe they'll tell people, go get Chromium if you want to use these features. We also have web Bluetooth scanning. This seems like a bad idea. Allows websites to scan for nearby Bluetooth LE devices. Could possibly go wrong. Yeah. The ambient light sensor. Web consortium, really? You okay? Let's websites get the current light level or luminance of the ambient light around the hosting device via the device's native sensors.
Designed to make the browser be more be like a built-in application.
Yes,
that's the whole point, really.
Yes.
Right. So you probably have many apps that do that, but you don't want your browser to do.
Yes, and we've talked often about how, you know, the browser is becoming sort of the replacement desktop.
Right.
You know, we browser web apps are now really a thing. We also have, get this, the HDCP, remember, you know, that's the high definition copy protection, HDCP. We have the HDCP policy check extension, which allows websites to check for HDCP policies used in media, streaming, and playback. Hmm. Okay. The proximity sensor allows websites to retrieve data about the distance between a device and an object as measured by a proximity sensor. Like what? The user? Okay. The web HID allows websites to retrieve information about locally connected human interface device, HID devices. And Leo, the serial API, as in a serial interface, allows websites to write and read data from your COM ports, from serial interfaces used by devices such as microcontrollers, 3D printers. So, okay, you know, hook up your 3D printer. The website is able to talk to it directly and print something, but not in Safari. The web USB lets websites communicate with devices via USB. Interesting. The geolocation sensor, a more modern version of the older geolocation API that lets websites access geolocation data. And maybe as a consequence of the still ongoing launch of the new third generation GPS satellite that happened between your previous podcast and this one,
that was cool.
That data got even more accurate, or will eventually, once it's up and in orbit. And then we have the user idle detection. Lets websites know when a user is idle. So, okay, all of those things, Apple feels, are not worthy of implementation. They are mostly implemented in Chromium-based browsers. Firefox has a few. Chrome will have none. And, of course, Apple feels that whereas third-party cookies were once the tracking mechanism of choice, as we know, they are readily blocked these days by savvy users. And much as I had my once naive hopes for the do not track header, and Leo, you always chuckled at that, and you were right, as you could adopt the phrase DNT was DOA, because it just never got off the ground.
No.
These days, in the place of cookies, the use of surreptitious fingerprinting has been steadily growing to the point that fingerprinting has now become the standard means of tracking users online for the advertising technology market. That's what the ad tech guys have ended up moving to is browser fingerprinting. So it's gone from sort of that's sort of an interesting idea to know that's the way we're going to track people now. And of course, its growth has been driven by the browser vendors who have steadily been adding more or less subtle, sometimes less subtle, anti-tracking features to their browsers in the interest of enhancing the privacy of their users. So, Apple said that WebKit's first line of defense against fingerprinting is not to implement web features which increase fingerprintability in the first place and offer no safe way to protect the user. And as for the traditional web APIs, which have been implemented in Safari for years, Apple has said it has been working to reduce their fingerprintability vector. Apple said that they had removed support for custom fonts, meaning that only presenting built-in fonts, which are the same for all users with the same system. We know that enumerating installed fonts is one of the ways that websites were fingerprinting users. They've also said they've removed minor software update information from the user agent string. So sort of, you know, fuzzing the version number so that it's not as specific. They've also removed the do not track flag, which ironically was being used as a fingerprinting vector. You know, if you had it turned on or turned off, it was generally sticky. And so it added one bit of fingerprinting disambiguation. So they just said, we're going to turn it off for everybody. Cannot be used. They've also removed support for any plugins on Mac OS. Other desktop ports may differ. And of course, plugins were never a thing on iOS, so nothing lost there. They require a user's permission for websites to access the device orientation and motion APIs on mobile devices, because the physical nature of motion sensors may allow for some additional device and they finally said that they prevent fingerprinting of attached cameras and microphones through the web real-time communications API. You know, that's the web RTC. So anyway, there again is Apple being proactive. And, you know, it sort of goes along with the Apple user profile, you know, a little less focused on gee whiz features and, you know, a little more on just solid functionality and increase in privacy and security. So good for those guys.
Okay.
Last Wednesday during Apple's developer conference, Tommy Pauly, who's internet technologies engineer at Apple, explained that the fall releases of iOS 14 and Mac OS 11 would both be supporting that much beloved DNS over HTTPS and also DNS over TLS protocols. And of course, you know, that's good news for encrypted DNS and privacy, kinda. From what Tommy said, it doesn't sound as though it's going to be a an immediately consumer-friendly feature, at least not at the start. He said that developers could create apps to apply DOH and DOT settings for the entire operating system via network extension apps or MDM profiles, or to individual apps or to an app's selected network requests. So, you know, mostly security-aware users, sounds like they would have to add it as like an app to their device in order to get entire iOS device or Mac using the DOH provider of their choice. You know, so I suppose somebody could create an app to enable that, but I don't get why not a setting in the OS's network settings. To me, that would seem to be a far better solution. Maybe Apple regards it as like an advanced feature. I don't know. Tommy said, quoting him, he said, there are two ways in which encrypted DNS can be enabled. The first way is to use a single encrypted DNS server as the default resolver for all apps on the system. He says, if you provide a public encrypted DNS server, you can now write a network extension app that configures the system to use your server. Or if you use mobile device management to configure enterprise settings on devices, you can push down a profile to configure encrypted DNS settings for your networks. He says the second way to enable encrypted DNS is to opt in directly from an app. If you want your app to use encrypted DNS, even if the rest of the system isn't yet, you can select a specific server to use for some or all of your app's connections. You know, so, I mean, that's nice, but it's very developer-centric in the way that they're approaching it. So, you know, it's not as much as we would like. I mean, what you'd like is just to have your iOS device use, you know, Cloudflare or NextDNS or 1.1.1.1 or any of the increasing number of DOH servers. So anyway, maybe they'll add that to us for us to iOS in the future. I guess we'll just have to wait and see how it goes. And now for some less than wonderful news. I wrote here, Mozilla plus Comcast plus DOH. I'm not sure whether that's strange bedfellows or strained bedfellows. But the disquieting news is that Comcast's Xfinity broadband internet service will be joining Firefox's Trusted Recursive Resolver program, you know, TRR, and somewhat even more worrisome, it will be enabled and Comcast will be the default DOH resolver for all Firefox users on Comcast's network. So in other words, for all Firefox, yeah, I know.
That stinks. I'm sure they gave him a packet of money.
That was my first thought, Leo, was that, you know, Mozilla needs financial support. Whenever I buy something, I've never mentioned this. Whenever I buy something through PayPal, often there's a little, you know, would you like to toss in a dollar to Mozilla? And I invariably say, yeah, thank you. You know, I'm happy to do that as a Firefox user. So I'm thinking, wait a minute. What has happened now is that if you are a Firefox user and you haven't done anything one way or the other, and you're a Comcast ISP, your Firefox will start using Comcast's DOH resolver by default.
That's
so let's enumerate
nice.
the many things that are fundamentally wrong with this picture. First, recall that it was in 2014 that Comcast was caught injecting unsolicited advertisements into its customers' browsing. And the U.S.'s broadband privacy rules were killed by Congress in 2017 when Congress passed a bill allowing ISPs to collect and sell web surfing data. Prior to President Trump's signing of that bill into law, as he immediately did with some flourish, the FCC's previous privacy rules would have required home internet and mobile broadband providers to first obtain consumers' opt-in consent before selling or sharing web browsing history, app usage history, and other private information with advertisers and other companies. But lawmakers used their authority under the Congressional Review Act to pass a joint resolution ensuring that the rules, quote, shall have no force or effect, unquote, and that the FCC cannot issue similar regulations in the future. Then recall how last year, as we talked about at the time, Comcast went ballistic and patently lied in congressional testimony about the move by the browser vendors to secure DNS. Remember that set of slides we reviewed at the time? It was like a PowerPoint presentation, which was just full of nonsense. That was created by Comcast and presented as part of Comcast's testimony to Congress. And in a joint letter to Congress, of which Comcast was a signatory, the letter read, "We would like to bring to your attention, you Congress, an issue that is of concern to all our organizations. Google is beginning to implement encrypted domain name system lookups into its Chrome browser and Android operating system through a new protocol for wireline and wireless service known as DNS over HTTPS, DOH. If not coordinated with others in the internet ecosystem, this could interfere on a mass scale with critical internet functions."
BS. I'm sorry. Did I say that out loud?
Yes, good. I'm glad you did. As well as raise data competition issues. What? They said Google is unilaterally moving forward with centralizing encrypted domain name requests within Chrome and Android rather than having DNS queries dispersed amongst hundreds of providers. When a consumer or enterprise uses Google's Android phones or Chrome web browser, Android or Chrome would make Google the encrypted DNS lookup provider by default, and most consumers would have limited practical knowledge or ability to detect or reject that choice.
Just as you, the members of Congress.
So now they're doing exactly the same
have
thing.
No
right?
ability to detect BS at all, Pod.
Because the majority of worldwide internet traffic, both wired and wireless, runs through the Chrome browser or the Android operating system, Google could become the overwhelmingly predominant DNS lookup provider. Moreover, the centralized control of encrypted DNS threatens to harm consumers by interfering with a wide range of services provided by ISPs, both enterprise and public-facing, and others, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, everyone gets the idea. And so here's the thing that occurs to me when we talk about our ISP doing this, remember that locally resolved DNS has never been a privacy issue as far as the wider internet is concerned. When a consumer does use their own ISP's local DNS resolver, their queries never emerge onto the internet. As we know, the local resolver is also a cache, which is able to satisfy most queries without asking anyone else. And when the local cache provided by the ISP doesn't contain the answer being sought, it, and not the ISP's customer, goes out onto the internet to issue one or more queries of other DNS servers to obtain and then cache the answer on behalf of the customer. In other words, the entire point of using DOH in the first place is specifically and only to blind the user's own ISP to the content of their DNS queries, which many people feel is none of the ISP's business. My point is, nope, there's no privacy implication as far as the rest of the internet is concerned when a user, you know, leaves their DNS settings alone and uses the ISP's local cache. That doesn't go out on the internet. It's that we're not happy about the ISP snooping on our DNS queries. So, yeah, we would rather send it to Cloudflare or to Google or to NextDNS or to whomever. You know, we're telling our ISP to keep their nose out of our business. And based on past evidence and behavior, it's clear that our ISPs are every bit as desperate to know our business as is every other entity out on the internet. They want to track our behavior and our actions. So the speedy deployment of browser-based DOH, which, you know, frankly, it's been surprising. I've talked about it in the past, just how quickly this happened. It was inevitable that ISPs would, as quickly as they could, be bringing up their own DOH servers to recapture those DNS lookups that they were rapidly being blinded to. And what's most distressing is that we're going to witness the tyranny of the default, swinging Firefox users away from Cloudflare and NextDNS, which was what Firefox was going to be doing, and initially to Comcast and probably eventually to other ISPs, which are all going to want to be bringing up their own DOH servers just for this purpose. Mozilla's announcement said, "Mozilla, the maker of Firefox, and Comcast have announced Comcast as the first internet service provider to provide Firefox users with private and secure encrypted domain name system services through Mozilla's Trusted Recursive Resolver program. Comcast has taken major steps to protect customer privacy as it works to evolve DNS resolution." Eric Riscorla, Firefox's CTO, said, quote, "Comcast has moved quickly to adopt DNS encryption technology, and we're excited to have them join the TRR program. Bringing ISPs into the TRR program helps us protect user privacy online without disrupting existing user experiences. We hope this sets a precedent for further cooperation between browsers and ISPs." And for its part, Comcast has reaffirmed its commitment to the privacy of their users. Their explicit statement about privacy highlights 3 points. And, you know, maybe by saying it, they're going to be bound by it. I don't know. They said, "As your internet service provider, we do not track the websites you visit or apps you use through your broadband connection. Because we don't track that information, we don't use it to build a profile about you, and we have never sold that information to anyone. 2, we do not sell and have never sold information that identifies who you are to anyone. We also don't sell and have never sold your location data when you use our Xfinity mobile service. And third and final, we delete the DNS queries we have as an internet service provider every 24 hours. So, you know.
Well, that's good if they really do all that. I thought they were selling it. I mean, they have the right to sell it.
Yeah, they do have the right to sell it. They've said they wouldn't, but then we've all asked, okay, then why are you fighting so hard to be able to?
Right.
So, you know, they are saying they're not doing it, so let's hope they aren't.
Well, you can still – it's just the default, so I could still choose Cloudflare. Or,
yes. Yeah. And, in fact, that's exactly the point I wanted to make. I wanted to – for our Comcast-connected Firefox-using listeners, be aware that if you care, Firefox will – at some point, and Mozilla hasn't said when, this is just an announcement of this agreement, it'll switch over to Comcast away from whatever it was using before. So you may want to, you know, override that and switch back to some non-ISP provider if it's something that you care about.
Yeah. That's so weird. And that they would
Leo,
care so much.
I know, isn't it odd?
Yeah.
But it makes sense. I mean, they, you know, ISPs don't want to be blinded.
Right.
But on the other point, it was never really a security issue if you were using a local provider, because your queries never left the ISP's network. They stayed in-house.
Right. Oh,
let's take our second break.
Yes, sir. Time to talk a little bit about Red Hat and OpenShift. Red Hat. Nice. Oh, you know the names. I know you do. When I say the name Red Hat, a lot of you are going to think Linux, though, right? Because, hey, I think that we were talking in the Twit community about the first Linuxes we installed. And Red Hat was one of the first. I think it was the first one I installed that worked. Let's put it that way. 20 years ago. Huh. But that's more than just Linux. Of course, it's been one of the best Linux distros for at least 20 years, served thousands of enterprise customers well for a total of 8 dot releases. So what Red Hat did for Linux, it's now doing for container orchestration with Red Hat OpenShift. It combines the best of Kubernetes with additional features like service mesh and operators, serverless, and more. These help developers and sysadmins do their work with greater ease and automation. No downloads or configuration required to get your hands on a cluster. And what's more, the tutorials aren't gated. They're there for you. You don't have to give up your contact information. No one's going to email you. No one's going to call you afterward. You can read all about it. So for those of you who've heard about OpenShift and want to give it a try, Red Hat has set up a free, ungated, interactive learning portal. It's got pre-configured OpenShift instances accessible there from your browser. You can really get a sense of what OpenShift can do for you. If you're curious, and I bet you are, about Red Hat OpenShift and how it works, check out its features. It's all there for you. OpenShift.com/security now. OpenShift. OpenShift.com/security now. We love Red Hat. Have for years. Somewhere I got a red fedora from Red Hat. If you want to know more about their orchestration systems, openshift.com/security now. Thank you, Red Hat, for supporting Security Now. They all know Steve, I'll tell you. Mr. G.
So we have the very welcome Facial Recognition and Biometric Technology Moratorium Act. It was proposed last Thursday by 2 senators and 2 representatives in Congress. Although a growing number of U.S. cities has already been taking action to ban the government use of that technology, with Boston just last week becoming the 10th U.S. city to do so, this bill, if it were passed, would put in place the first nationwide ban on facial recognition technology. And I don't know where this falls on political partisan lines. So, you know, maybe it's, you know, dead before it's even voted on. Who knows? But the sense is that the use of facial recognition technology, we've been talking about it a lot on the podcast, has sort of sprung up unbidden because it had suddenly become feasible and practical. You know, we got lots of computation, we got lots of connectivity, we got lots of storage in the cloud. So, what could we do with all of that? Oh, we got lots of cameras too. So let's hook everything together. And that sounds like a good idea. But the nation's lawmakers have never been given the opportunity to officially or unofficially weigh in on whatever limitations and guidelines, if any, should be imposed on this. It just kind of happened organically.
They probably want to know what Comcast thinks first before they vote. To wait for that letter, they'll tell you what to do.
We reserve the right. The newly proposed bill would, quote, prohibit biometric surveillance by the federal government without explicit statutory authorization and to withhold certain federal public safety grants from state and local governments, that is the stick, that engage in biometric surveillance, unquote. So that means that federal agencies would be barred from using biometric surveillance systems, which in addition to facial recognition can also include voice recognition. Additionally, it would prohibit the use of federal dollars to be spent on facial recognition technology and, quote, condition federal grant funding to state and local entities, including law enforcement, on those entities enacting their own moratoria on the use of facial recognition and biometric technology, unquote. So there's no time limit in place. It would continue until Congress passes a law to lift it, which is, I think, exactly the way it should be done. Just say no until, you know, we decide what, you know, how we want to treat it, what, you know, how we feel about it, what restrictions to put on it. And of course, the privacy concerns around facial recognition have been one thing. And specifically, especially in today's climate, the inadvertent apparent racial bias repeatedly demonstrated by the technology, all of this came into focus earlier last week when the ACLU filed a complaint alleging that an African-American man was arrested in Detroit after a facial recognition system falsely matched his photo with security footage of a shoplifter. According to the ACLU, this is the first known example of misidentification through faulty facial recognition directly leading to a wrongful arrest. Apparently, that the technology was simply believed. The senior legislative counsel with the ACLU said, no one should have to go through what the Williams family has gone through. It's past time Congress halted the use of facial recognition and stopped federal money from being used to invest in invasive and discriminatory surveillance. And coincidentally, a forthcoming research paper to be published by Springer Publishing of Berlin, Germany, bears the somewhat ominous title, quote, a deep neural network model to predict criminality using image processing. What? Anyway, it describes AI algorithms that can predict crime based only on a person's face. I'm not kidding. In response, at last count, this was last night when I checked, 2,435 professors, researchers, practitioners, and students spanning all fields of anthropology, sociology, computer science, law, science and technology studies, information science, math, and more, including experts and academics from organizations including MIT, Microsoft, Harvard, and Google, had all signed an open letter denouncing this paper and calling it out for promoting racial bias. And if anyone's interested, signed piece, I have a link. It was published on Medium.com last Tuesday, entitled Abolish the Technology to Prison Pipeline, with a subheading, Crime Prediction Technology Reproduces Injustices and Causes Real Harm. And anyway, it was published by the Coalition. Huh?
It's like phrenology. Like, oh, the bumps on this person's head tell me he must be a criminal type. You can't look at somebody's face and say they're a criminal unless you just assume the skin tone tells all. Which I bet
that's the bias that we've seen, which is horrific.
That's exactly what this is.
And as we previously noted on the podcast, Microsoft, Amazon, and IBM, which all have developed their own facial recognition platforms, have all recently banned the sale of the technology to police departments and pushed for federal laws to regulate the technology. So they're saying, yes, please regulate this. You know, we have the technology. We've seen what it can do. We need some guidance here. Senator Markley, who is one of the four who co-sponsored this, said in his statement about the proposed legislation, quote, facial recognition technology doesn't just pose a grave threat to our privacy. It physically endangers Black Americans and other minority populations in our country. At this moment, the only responsible thing to do is to prohibit government and law enforcement from using these surveillance mechanisms, unquote. So that's the happy proposed legislation. We will see how that fares through the U.S. legislative process. The not-so-happy legislative proposal is titled the Lawful Access to Encrypted Data Act.
At least they're being honest.
And there it is, folks. Yes, right out in the exactly, open. Leo.
Yeah.
The Lawful Access to Encrypted Data Act. Let's not call this the Earn It. We're going to take away Section 230 protection. No. So this new legislation was introduced by the U.S. Senate's Judiciary Committee Chairman, Lindsey Graham, Senator Tom Cotton, and Marsha Blackburn. They argued that ending the use of, and they used the term, warrant-proof encrypted technology would, quote, bolster national security interests and, quote, better protect communities across the country. They added that such encryption cloaks illicit behavior during criminal investigations into terrorists and other bad actors. And of course, as we know, there's been no other single topic that has so captured my own interest and attention, along with the more recent question of managing the posting and presentation of counterfactual information on the web. The question of whether encryption should remain warrant-proof is the issue of the day, and it's going to be fascinating to watch this play out. As we know, we already have last year's Earn It Act, also introduced by Senator Lindsey Graham, which I, in the show notes, I called a can of slime, whose language begins, quote, a bill to establish a national commission on online child exploitation prevention and for other purposes, unquote.
And as it's the other purposes that scare me.
Yeah, and some other things. Don't worry about those. Pay no attention. Just think about the kids. And as we know, it threatens to revoke a non-complying company's legal protections under Section 230, which shields the company from criminal and civil liability for user-generated content. I much prefer, if nothing else, a straightforward heads-up fight over what we're really talking about. Tom Cotton, one of the bill's three co-sponsors, said, quote, tech companies' increasing reliance on encryption has turned their platforms into a new lawless platform of criminal activity. Criminals from child predators to terrorists are taking full advantage. This bill will ensure law enforcement can access encrypted material with a warrant based on probable cause and help put an end to the Wild West of crime on the internet, unquote. So, okay, good luck with that. We all know as has often been said on this podcast and others on the TWiT network, that lawful users will obtain weaker privacy protection, while actual criminals, who will be much more motivated to hide their illicit activity, will simply switch to non-US platforms that continue to provide warrant-proof encryption. And in a somewhat bizarre carrot and stick, this latest attempt at legislation also directs, get this, Leo, our illustrious Attorney General, Bill Barr, to create a prize competition to award participants who create a lawful access solution in an encrypted environment. Okay, so we know that Apple or Signal or Facebook are not going to be signing up for that prize, though I suppose this might be an effort to spur some innovation to get some smaller players to propose technological solutions, since Congress has been unable to get any of the actual purveyors of this technology to even consider doing so. So anyway, we'll see how that goes. Who knows? None of this legislation ever seems to go beyond the proposal stage. And I assume that's because, presumably, those who query members in Congress about their feelings and probable votes never get even close to imagining that those bills have a snowflake's chance of actually passing. So, again, at least this is just, as you said, Leo, it's telling the truth. It's just saying, look, we want to end warrant-proof encryption. What say ye? And, we'll find out, because it's just been proposed. On another legislative side, we have Michigan's state legislative house, which just passed and I don't know why they had to do this, but I'm glad, the Microchip Protection Act. Even though forced RFID chip implants for workers is not yet, thank goodness, an issue, the state of Michigan decided to join 7 other states in getting out in front of this one by formally and preemptively outlawing compulsory microchip implants for employees. Whoa. Big brother, anyone? The legislation notes that although there are only a few known U.S.-based companies embedding microchips in their employees, several job providers could be following soon. So they said, including some businesses in Michigan. So assuming that this legislation passes, which appears likely, Michigan would become the 8th state to explicitly outlaw compulsory chipping. The existing 7 states are California, Maryland, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Wisconsin, and Utah. All of those already prohibit the required implantation of a microchip in any person for any reason, not just employees. So I have a feeling that that's going to be, taking all of this a step too far. So, I guess like for any reason, that would even mean like convicts and criminals and things. No, we're not doing RFID tagging of people in this country. And I imagine that this is just the beginning. We're a federation of states, so it's 8 states now. I would imagine we'll see something nationwide before long. Oh, and I wanted to mention, just sort of as a heads up, not to forget about VirusTotal. A recent blog posting, a VirusTotal blog posting, announced a new addition to Google's multi-malware scanner. And I got a kick out of the title, and it was kind of some clever programmer-ese. The blog was titled VirusTotal plus equals Cynet. For those not conversant in coding, the plus equals expression happens to be one of my favorites. It's a simplification of A equals A plus B. It should always be the goal of computer languages to both minimize writing errors and maximize reading ease. So shortening A equals A plus B to A plus equals B is vastly easier to both write and to read. It's easier to read because it explicitly reveals the programmer's intent to increase A by B. It's true that the longer version does the same, but the intent is much less clear. And especially if the A expression happened to be some really complex thing, you don't want to have to type that twice on both sides of the equal sign and then add a B to the end. And if it's really long and complex, someone reading the code looks at it and thinks, wow, what's going on? And then they have to like very carefully make sure that the complex expression is in fact the same on both sides of the equal sign. Anyway, plus equals is a win. Cynet is a new addition to VirusTotal, and the VirusTotal blog quoted Cynet saying, Cynet 360 is an autonomous breach protection platform that includes multi-layered anti-malware capabilities, including AI-based static analysis, process behavior monitoring, memory monitoring, sandboxing, and granular whitelisting, interlocking all together to protect against malicious executables, exploits, scripts, macros, malicious process injection, and other fileless attacks. They said Cynet 360 protection ranges across the entire malware lifecycle, identifying malicious attributes, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so that's just an ad for them. But they are a good stand-up company, and they will now be contributing their input into things dropped into VirusTotal. I wanted to mention it mostly to remind our listeners about VirusTotal, a service which I use and frankly would hate to be without. Just the other day, I needed some piece of long abandoned software. I don't now remember what it was. So I went digging around the net and I ostensibly found it on Vetusware, V-E-T-U-S-ware, which is vetusware.com, which is an abandonware site that tends to collect abandonware, you know, arguably software which was once commercial, but which has been long abandoned by its publisher. And I think there's actually been some legislation protecting those who use abandoned software, saying, yeah, you have a legal right to do so. Much as I wanted to trust the download that I found.
The site has been abandoned.
Yeah. Well, now, Leo, it looks a lot like mine, so easy there.
I love the use of ASCII text characters for borders and shadows. That is a pure ASCII page.
Too.
Yes.
Anyway, so much as I wanted to trust the download, this is precisely how malware gets into people's machines, you know, downloading something that you think is okay and it's not. So I downloaded whatever it was I needed, inspected the package, checked file signatures, dates, and so forth. I did, you know, as much due diligence as I could. And for me, a key part of any such checking is always to drop any questionable file onto VirusTotal over at virustotal.com. Sometimes it instantly knows it because it does a hash of it, and it had already checked the file of that hash. But it's sometimes a good idea to refresh that. And in this case, I did, and I watched, I think, 73 different virus, you know, AV anti-malware engines all re-inspect that thing and say, yeah, far as we know, nothing wrong with this. And as it turns out, it was useful to me, and it was benign. So anyway, I'm not suggesting that anyone should regard anything VirusTotal tells you as gospel, but it's one additional piece of useful telemetry about anything you might have reason to question. So just remember that it's always there and it's free to use and just a great resource for, you know, security savvy people on the web. A little bit of miscellany regarding Edge on Win 7. I mentioned it last week, and I heard you confirm it the day after, Leo, with Paul and Mary Jo. As it happens, since then and now, I updated a Windows 7 machine of mine, which had been offline for quite a while, and it did receive an offer to install Edge. So Windows 7, we'd like to install Edge. The Win update, it was interesting the way it came in. It came in under Windows Update, which showed me that two important updates were available. But so it was important, but Edge was not selected for me by default. So if I didn't do anything, if I just, you know, like did the automatic express updates, I would not have received it. But if I looked at the itemization of updates, saw that it was important, I would have gone, oh, yeah, I'd like to have Edge on my Windows 7 machine. I could have selected it and installed it. I did that, and it did. It, you know, it installed it, and it worked. What I did think was interesting was that it was rather aggressive about copying Chrome's settings. Since it, of course, is a Chromium-based browser, you know, it really wanted to suck everything out of Chrome and, you know, and take over for it. And I did allow it to do so because I was just sort of curious to see how it would do. And sure enough, it installed all the same add-ons, including LastPass and uBlock Origin that I both had installed as add-ons in Chrome. So anyway, I know that there are still lots of Windows 7 users out there. And, you know, I don't know why somebody who is using Chrome would also want Edge. You know, it's just one more browser. But, you know, Microsoft has been telegraphing that they're going to be adding a bunch of features like vertical tabs. So, you know, maybe. I also wanted to note, for those who are old school NNTP news group users, apparently there are about 1,000 of you, since I think about 1,000 copies of the Gravity newsreader have been downloaded since I added it to GRC's list of downloads. I wanted to just give a quick heads up that there's a new release of that. I fixed a bug in the one that we had online, 3.0.9. The bug was not mine. A couple of weeks ago, Gravity users, including myself, were unable to open several recent postings in the grc.spinrite.dev newsgroup, where I'm spending all my time. Gravity would just crash. It would just close, bang, whenever you touched on one or two of those posts. And this is really where community-driven open source software really comes into its own. Gravity, as we know, was abandoned, I think, in 2010, you know, quite a while ago. But it is by far my favorite way of interacting with newsgroups, and newsgroups are by far the best way I've ever found of working with a community of people who are interested in participating in the development testing of new code, which is what we are very busy doing at the moment. So when my trusty old Gravity died a couple weeks ago, well, actually first, remember that it died when the year switched to 2020. There was just some code in there that it wasn't Y2K, it was Y2K20. It just died. So I needed to open up and fix it at that time. I learned a little bit about Gravity, brought it into the fold. I now have, you know, its source tree living with me. And so when it crashed 2 weeks ago, I went back in and I found a long-standing problem. Somebody, the original author, I mean, this thing had never worked. If you embedded two Base64 encodings into a posting, which is the way Thunderbird does things, because Thunderbird has a news reader also, and you tried to open that in Gravity, it would crash. The original programmer forgot to put the length of a string into the into one of the string abstractions. You know, when have we ever heard of that happening before? And sure enough, it would crash if the base 64 decoder ran off the end of the first one and into the beginning of the second one. It would hit an equal sign, which it regarded as a reserved character because base 64 uses that for padding, and it would explode. So anyway, I fixed it. And for anybody who did download a copy of Gravity, you'll want to go update your copy just so that you have the latest and greatest. Also, a bit of feedback from a listener, Blue LED. He tweeted me at SGGRC. Can you tell us again what was the brand and model of the switch/router you were using for traffic control? It was not a common brand, as I remember. Okay, so the software is PFSense, P-F-S-E-N-S-E. It is open source, based upon FreeBSD Unix, and it is wonderful. It can be loaded onto any Intel-based PC hardware, which FreeBSD supports, and it supports everything and going way back in time. So you do need to have some fast network interfaces if you're going to make it your router, because, of course, all of your LAN traffic would be coming and going through it. So that's one requirement. But, you know, it is perfect for a DIY user. You could also get like any cute little inexpensive Intel-based fanless turnkey box and load PFSense onto it, and you're up and running with a feature-packed router. But for someone who wants a PFSense-based appliance, the company NetGate offers a turnkey, ready-to-go PFSense-based router. Actually, they have a family of them. The smallest, least expensive, is the SG1100, no relation. It sells for $179. It's the one that I'm using at several of my locations. I think it runs up to 895 megabits, so just shy of a gig of measured throughput. So it should handle anybody, you know, like who has a 300 megabyte connection, as I do from Cox. Anyway, NetGate, NetGate.com. And I've got the links in the show notes for anyone who's interested. And work on Spinrite's AHCI driver is continuing. We're making rapid progress. I don't have anything specific yet to announce, though I did notice that more than 1,500 people had grabbed a copy of our new initdisk utility, which I mentioned last week for reformatting USB drives. So I'm glad it's being useful to people. And Leo,
let's take
our final break. And then we will talk about Ripple 20 again.
Did you contribute the fix to Gravity back to the open source, or is it even on GitHub or anywhere?
I didn't. I contacted all the maintainers who I could find. None of them replied. I have no way.
It's just gone. Where'd you get the source from? Just have it forever lying around?
No, the source is on, I think it's on SourceForge, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
So they had posted the source. The last one was, I think, back in 2010.
Yeah.
And anybody who wants it is welcome to it, but there's no uptake of it. So I will just be maintaining it myself and keep it alive.
Steve's Gravity. It's all his now. Our show today brought to you by ExpressVPN, folks. You're not going online without a VPN these days, now that we know Comcast.
They don't
sell that data. They just collect it. They probably aggregate it.
They don't want it, but for some reason they didn't want to be blinded to it.
Yeah. So, by the way, if you're using ExpressVPN, you don't need to use DOH because everything you do, including your DNS lookups, are all obscured as you travel through the tunnel. So that's really a lot of the reasons people use ExpressVPN. Now that we don't congregate at coffee shops as much, Of course, anytime you're on an open Wi-Fi network, you got to have a VPN. And I choose ExpressVPN for a lot of reasons. But also it's about privacy. You know, you don't want your ISP to be snooping on what you're doing. You don't, now that we know that they don't, right? Uh-huh, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I still want to use ExpressVPN. And one of the things that is so important about ExpressVPN is privacy. They do not log your data. Steve's always said that's kind of table stakes for a virtual private network. It's not always the case, though. A lot of free and cheap VPNs, that's exactly how they monetize. You know, it's not cheap running all those servers. They do it by watching what you're doing, selling what you're doing, sometimes even injecting ads into your traffic, not ExpressVPN. In fact, they're so committed to this, they actually created their own technology called Trusted Server. Spins up when you log in, runs entirely in RAM, cannot write to disk, and then when you log out, it's gone, and so is every trace of your visit. It can't log, it can't keep track, because it can't write to the disk, it can't do anything. It's just one more way ExpressVPN kind of stands behind their privacy commitment. And by the way, independent third-party audit on both their privacy policy and Trusted Server. The other thing I love about ExpressVPN, because they have 90 different countries, they have servers all over the world, lots of them, it's the fastest out there. Fast enough you can watch HD video. And actually, that's good news, because if you've used up all your Netflix viewing, if there's nothing more you want to see on Netflix, good news. Use ExpressVPN, put yourself in England, suddenly refresh Netflix, you can watch Netflix UK, or you can, by the way, works with Hulu, works with a lot of different streaming services, so it broadens your horizons. You can travel without leaving your house. Speeds are great, HD video is great, no lag. I actually tested myself, I left it on one device, I turned it on one device and left it on, and I can't remember which device, and honestly, I can't tell. It does. It's so fast. No wonder it's the number one VPN in the world. CNET, Wired, The Verge all agree. Me too. Protect yourself. Protect your security. Protect your privacy. And eliminate geographic restrictions with the best VPN in the world. Worldwide, too. It's the VPN I use and trust. ExpressVPN. Go to expressvpn.com/security now. You can get 3 extra months free when you sign up for a 1-year package. Brings the cost down below $7 a month. It's well worth it. Well worth that triple venti latte or whatever it is you're drinking, these quadruple octo venti lattes. Go to expressvpn.com/security now to learn more. expressvpn.com/security now. Good people doing a really, really good thing. Steve?
So, Ripple 22, as in also... More. Mucho.
Oh, boy.
Details.
Yikes.
Yeah. Last week was our disclosure and discussion of the very worrisome Ripple 20 discovery that a highly used for several decades embedded TCP/IP stack was riddled with at least 15 vulnerabilities, several of the worst being very serious, no user action required, remote code execution enablers. I ended that discussion last week by noting that the internet's already target-rich environment just got a whole lot worse. So we're back to this important topic this week as a great many more details of the impact of this sweeping industry-wide problem are coming to light. And the sense is we still don't know the full scope of it. But our often cited friends over at Bleeping Computer have pulled together the most comprehensive coverage I've seen. So I'm going to start by paraphrasing a bit of what they've written because it nicely characterizes the industry's present situation. Bleeping Computer wrote, "The dust is far from settled following the disclosure of the 19 vulnerabilities in the TCP/IP stack from Trek, collectively referred to as Ripple 20, which could help attackers take full control over vulnerable devices on the network. Trek's code is fundamental for the embedded devices it is implemented on because it bestows network communication to them and is present on gadgets used in a variety of sectors, technology, medical, construction, mining, printing, energy, software, industrial control systems, telecom, retail, and commerce. The company has notified its customers and issued patches. But a week after the Ripple 20 announcement from security research group JSOF, the full impact still remains unclear. This is because Trex code is licensed and distributed under different names or serves as a foundation for a new network stack. And I'll interject that it turns out that it's also internationalized, resold, and rebranded under completely different names as well. So it's very possible that a mid-chain OEM might even know that their system is using vulnerable code that originated with Trek. I mean, this is that whole the reason they called it Ripple is that of the nature of today's supply chain, where somebody could get this embedded in a chip. Somebody then uses the chip that, oh, look, it's IP enabled. It's like, yeah, they don't even know that it's Trek code in there because, you know, that affiliation didn't survive the embedding process. So concerted efforts from national-level cybersecurity agencies and private companies in the field are ongoing to identify businesses with products vulnerable to issues in the Ripple 20 vulnerability set. What is clear at the moment, they wrote, though, is that the healthcare industry is particularly affected and should be on high alert. And of course, you know, this is interesting because it's sort of the nature of embeddedness. There's some provider that created the core embedded chips, which either A or multiple major biomedical firm used. And, you know, an engineer chose it. It did the job. It was exactly that. It was, you know, a turnkey solution that would connectivity enable their infusion pumps, example. And then they just kept using it. And they used it for years and years because it, you know, it stayed available and it worked and they never had any problems with it. And so, you know, as they evolved their line of biomedical equipment, they just kept using it. And when they added some other piece of equipment, they said, hey, let's just use the same chip. Why not? It works. And, you know, the Trek products do work. The problem is they've also got vulnerabilities. So the healthcare industry has been put on a high alert about any of their connected stuff. Elad Luz, head of research at CyberMDX, which is a company focused on security and medical devices and is involved in identifying vulnerable products, told Bleeping Computer that their initial investigation placed the healthcare industry's exposure at more than 7 times that of manufacturing. And that was confirmed with some numbers by the security firm Forescout, who is also involved now in the effort. On the day of the disclosure, Forescout revealed that there were 6 times more vulnerable healthcare-related equipment than in the retail sector. So, what are the numbers? They have identified 52,935 devices matching the Trek signatures in the healthcare vertical segment, 8,347 devices in the retail segment, 7,333 devices in manufacturing, 5,904 devices in government, 5,225 in financial services, and generically an additional 11,346 in other fields. They explained from their analysis, Forescout did, that the most common device types running Trek stacks were infusion pumps, and then second were printers, then UPS systems, networking equipment, point-of-sale devices, IP cameras, video conferencing systems, building automation devices, and industrial control systems. They added that to exploit Ripple 20 vulnerabilities, an attacker needs a direct connection to an affected device or a routed path to one on an internal network. This means devices directly connected to the internet, of course, are those most at risk, just like routers. An attacker could target these devices first, compromise the device, then move laterally within the network to access or infect other devices. So, for example, the last thing you want is your IP camera to be on the internet, able to, you know, like with a port, even if the port is not a server. If it's not, you know, visible, it is still, if it's got a port connected, these vulnerabilities can get there. Because, for example, an unsolicited DNS reply can be used to compromise one of these Trek stack-based devices. So, as an example of the impact of the vulnerabilities, Forescout did a series of Shodan searches for 37 specific known vulnerable device models where the model number was known, encompassing 18 different vendors. That included printers, IP cameras, video conferencing systems, networking equipment, and industrial control devices. That Shodan search revealed 15,000 currently internet-connected instances of these devices with Trek stacks that could be immediately compromised by anyone on the internet. You know, and when you include networking equipment and industrial control systems, especially when you hear what some of these industrial control systems are, that's a problem. So compared to the number of known vulnerable devices estimated in the many hundreds of millions, 15,000 is not a big number. But that was only a scan for specific known vulnerable signatures. And after all, it only takes one exposed device on the network of, say, a nuclear power plant or managing a nation's electric power grid to ruin everyone's day. It is estimated that the actual number of publicly exposed internet-connected devices is a great deal higher. They just aren't readily identifiable from a Shodan scan, or they have not been identified yet. So, you know, that remains for, you know, the short-term foreseeable future. Bleeping Computer assembled a nice, almost alphabetical list. I alphabetized it a bit. Of known affected manufacturers and their devices. To give our listeners some sense, we have the big iron provider, Aruba Networks. A preliminary advisory from them, based on an initial investigation, is available from them. It lists their level 2 and level 3 switches produced under the Aruba or HP ProCurve brand names. Baxter US, they're a healthcare company. They announced that some of their Spectrum Infusion Systems wireless battery modules are impacted by Ripple 20 because they run something known as the DigiNet OS, which uses Trek's TCP/IP stack. We'll talk about Digi in a second. They list 5 different Wi-Fi wireless battery modules with, you know, B, B, G, A, B, G, N, and so forth. And we know what those are. Those are the Wi-Fi designations. So they've got the Ripple 20 Trek stack in them. And, you know, I don't know what mischief somebody could get up to, but it's not a vulnerability you probably want in something which is presumably infusing drugs into you at a prescribed pace. Yeah.
Let's not hack that.
Yeah. Braun, another medical and pharmaceutical device company, notified their purchasers that vulnerable Trek code is present in their Outlook 400 ES safety infusion pump, and no other products are affected in the Ripple 20 issues. A Braun advisory stated that to date, Braun has received 24 patches from Trek to resolve vulnerabilities in the software. They said, we've analyzed the patches and determined that 20 of them are not applicable to the Outlook 400ES platform. Four remaining patches continue to be analyzed to determine the scope. So that's good. That says that Braun purchased directly from Trek. Trek has been responsible. They've resolved the problem, and they're notifying their direct customers. Of course, the problem is with the indirect customers that Trek has no way of notifying. And we don't know if the direct customers have a way of notifying their, you know, down the chain OEMs. Beck HMS Industrial Networks is another, and I'm rather than going through it, I'm going through this in detail to give our listeners a sense. Carestream has a bunch of products that are vulnerable. Caterpillar is not being forthcoming with details, but an undisclosed number of Caterpillar's products are known to be vulnerable. I don't know what that means. Cisco also, and boy, Cisco is apparently a user of this Trek stack. Routing and switching, enterprise and service provider, the ASR 5000 series routers, GGSN gateway, GPRS support, IP services gateway. These are all just a whole bunch of Cisco system architecture evolution gateway. So yikes. And they're still investigating and we'll be showing more of them. Dell said Dell products are inherited from an Intel component that is present in Dell client platforms and from Teradici, T-E-R-A-D-I-C-I firmware and remote workstation cards in Dell Precision and Dell Wise, W-Y-S-E, zero client products. So interesting that they're saying they inherited it through an Intel component. That's interesting. They've released fixes and encourage customers to prioritize updating their systems to the latest firmware. Also, Digi International has something called NetOS 7, which is a resold platform. It's got problems, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, I don't know, 12 or so of those, and a whole bunch of model numbers on each of those. New firmware versions are available. They're being responsible, but it's up to people to install them. And the multinational power management company, Eaton, announced in a security bulletin that its products rely on Trek's library to implement IPv4, IPv6, UDP, DNS, HTTP, TCP, ICMPv4. Remember that all of those were vulnerable protocols of Trek's library, and they are vulnerable to multiple Ripple 20 issues. Unfortunately, these things have sort of scary names. The CL7 voltage regulator control, the Form 4D recloser control, the Form 6 recloser control, Edison IDEA and IDEA Plus relays, all variants are vulnerable. The metered input power distribution units, the metered outlet power distribution units, the managed power distribution units, and the high density power distribution units. So, yeah, let's hope there's no grid outages anytime in the near future. Green Hill Software, HCL Technologies, Hewlett Packard Enterprise, HP Inc. and Samsung, HP Laser, LaserJet Pro, the HP Never Stop Laser. Maybe it should stop while you update its firmware. The Samsung Pro Express, the Multi Express, the DeskJet, OfficeJet, OfficeJet Pro, Ink Tank, Smart Tank. You're in the tank. No. You definitely want to see about getting updated firmware. We've talked about the problem with printer firmware vulnerabilities in the past. It is a favorite pivot point. There was just also something recently about printers opening a port to the public internet you don't want it to be one of these printers or one that hasn't had its firmware updated, because that would be bad. That's a way to get in and pivot into your network. Also, Intel. Some versions of Intel's Active Management Technology, AMT, if I'm not mistaken, that's part of the baseband technology in the motherboard. So, which is to say that Intel is using the Trek stack in the motherboard baseband firmware to do all of the active management technology, which, as we know, cannot be turned off. So let's hope that people have those servers, the ports that have those servers are not facing the public and on the internet. That would not be good. Max Linear, Rockwell Automation, Schneider Electric, lots of vulnerabilities across Schneider's line of UPS devices. Teradici, I mentioned before, they've acknowledged the problem, and I'm sure they're notifying their customers. Xerox, Xerox B205, B210, and B215, whatever those are, they've got firmware updates, but of course, you got to go get them. And then Zunken Elmic, a company distributes Terex stack under the name Kazago, K-A-G-O. So if you don't know Terex, you may know that name. That's an example of one of these redistributors of the Terex stack under a different name. So anyway, as we said last week, this is the vulnerability that I have a feeling we're going to be hearing about. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about it again. The problem is the bad guys who find it are going to be quiet about it. They're going to be using it as a way of getting into people's networks and taking advantage of what is unfortunately a long-standing, widely used stack in embedded IoT devices. It's definitely something bad guys are going to be probing for. So the advice for our listeners is this is just a good time to think about all the stuff you've got, printers, routers, IP cameras. Just, you know, go be proactive. Too few of these things update themselves, especially if they've been around for a long time. If there's new firmware for them, it's worth installing it.
Now, did I miss it, or did you skip the picture of the week?
I skipped it. It was I didn't think it was that noteworthy. It's just kind of fun.
Well, I don't, you know, it's there. Yeah. I'll just show it for those of you watching at home. Yeah. People were saying in the chat room, I thought, no, I don't remember that part. So, and since I'm the guy who's pushing the buttons, I should remember it. It's just a picture of a hard drive. Yeah. Guy's looking at it with a magnifying glass, writing the ones and zeros. Silly, silly. At least he's wearing gloves. I think he's wearing buddies.
It probably was a photo that someone tweeted me. I thought it was a fun picture of the week. The person is wearing grease-proof cotton gloves.
Oh, so what that
and
is.
They're probably dust-proof.
Yeah.
So it was meant to be a clean room environment where they'd open the drive. And,
That's funny.
You can't actually use a microscope. Now, they're actually in the old days, in the MFM drive days, there was a fluid you could put on the surface of a disc. Yes. And it would show, it would resolve the magnetic poles of the data.
Holy cow.
You actually could, with a magnifying glass, you actually could read it. The bits were that big.
That's amazing.
But that stopped being true a long time ago.
Steve Gibson, he will always be big in our imagination and in our esteem. Every week we do the Security Now show. You can tune in and watch us do it live round about 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Tuesdays, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. So Tuesday afternoon or evening, tune on by YouTube. It's on YouTube Live, but actually the best thing to do is go to our website, twit.tv/live, and you can pick your stream. No more Mixer, I'm sorry to say, but there's still plenty of other streams there. Yeah, twit.tv/live. Steve's got a number of different unique versions of the show. His world famous 16 kilobit edit, which just sounds wonderful. And then he also has the transcripts, which no one else has. That's so you can, that, you know, he has it all transcribed by Elaine Ferris, so as you can read along as you listen. And he has 64 kilobit versions. GRC.com. While you're there, pick up Spin Right on, well on its way, I might add, well on its way to 6.1.
You're underway.
If you buy it now, you'll get the next edition for free. You'll also get to participate in the beta testing. That's Spin Right at GRC.com. He's got lots of other free stuff there, like Shields Up and so forth. So go on over and see that. We have the show, audio and video of the show at our site, twit.tv/SN. It's also on YouTube in a store and forward fashion. Best thing to do, though, use that fancy RSS reader you've got there that's known as a podcast program, a podcatcher. Subscribe to Security Now, and it'll automatically download it the minute it's available of a Tuesday evening. So you'll have it for your Wednesday morning drive down to the store to pick up more brisket. My brisket's frozen for the whole show. It's been at 137 degrees. Stalled, they call it. It's stalled. You know, it's interesting. There's a whole science about that. People weren't sure why brisket would stall for a couple of hours, just stop at a temperature. Turns out it's evaporating the liquid. It's actually cooling itself, so it can't get any hotter. Once all the liquid's gone, I told Lisa this. She believed me. It will start to heat up. So I'm going to go home and watch my brisket. So, everybody, thank you for being here. Thank you, Steve. Have a wonderful week. We'll see you next time on Security Now.
Thank you.
Come on over for some brisket. Come on over. It'll be done in about 18 hours.
Hey, folks, I am Micah Sargent, co-host of Tech News Weekly right here on the TWiT Network. Yes, Tech News Weekly is a show we do every week, Jason Howell and myself, where we talk to people who are making and are breaking the tech news. That's right, it's journalists, it's inventors, it's app makers, it's everybody who's bringing the tech news in a given week. It's all the stuff you want to know about in bite-sized chunks in a fantastic package. So be sure to subscribe. It's twit.tv/TNW.
Security Now.